Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is Neat. It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Woo-hoo.
And this week, we're getting kind of twisted.
So this week on the podcast, since we are mid-spooky season, we are going to be giving you 10 unusual, exotic, and unique spirits from around the world.
Yeah, and I want to say before we begin, this started as a venture to try to find, just like for lack of a better description, gross spirits. But a lot of the things that we found on these lists were not necessarily like in comparison to some of the things that we're going to talk about later, don't really fit in that category. They're more just like really unusual things that are very culturally specific and are not really mainstream.
Yeah.
But like, you know, are unusual and, you know, like not typically consumed by the world at large, but are really interesting things that we wanted to talk about.
I would say a lot of these things, if I came across, I would be absolutely excited as hell to try.
Yeah, especially if you were like traveling the world and you're like, well, when in Rome.
Yeah,
none of these things are from Rome, but this expression.
I'm very against, like, you know, bringing something like some of these very traditional like spirits into the conversation of like modern culture, being like, it's so weird and crazy and gross.
Yeah.
It's like, no,
this stuff is wild.
I mean, come on, alcohol is made from rotted stuff.
Yeah,
like that's what we drink. So it's all kind of it can be gross if you think about it, and it's also tasty and delicious and amazing. So all right. So so with that,
I think that brings us to our first one. I think you're gonna kick us off with this list.
Yeah, so the first one, it's one that came up on a lot of these searches for, like, weird or strange spirits. But which is funny to me because it's an incredibly, like, amazing traditional spirit. It's produced in South and Central America, and I'm talking about chicha.
Chicha.
Yeah. So chicha, when it first comes to mind, people think about a fermented corn beverage that is made by chewing maize or corn, like cornmeal.
Okay.
And then allowing that to cause the fermentation, which I'll get into the science of that in a second. But one thing that I found in my research is that it's actually, that term is kind of a blanket term for a lot of things. It can be fermented. It can be not fermented. It can be made, usually it's based in corn, but it can also have a lot of other stuff in it. It can have other fruits and grains, it can have nuts, all sorts of stuff can go into this. And it can vary widely from region to region and from household to household as to what is called chicha. The term, like, there's a little bit of a, you know, it's not clear on the etymology of the word, but it's kind of across the board seen as a way of just describing fermented beverages and just beverages at large in these cultures.
It's a little bit of an umbrella.
Yeah. But the practice of making chicha dates back to around the chicha that we're going to talk specifically about, which is fermented, dates back to around 5000 BC in Andean cultures. And it was important in, it could be used as currency. It was used as the center for spiritual rituals because intoxication was something that they saw as the way to get in touch with your, like, spiritual guides.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I thought this was cool, because really what we're talking, like, it's sort of more like a beer. It's not a distilled spirit. It's a fermented spirit. So really, when you talk about the first beer that was made in the Americas, and even in America, because there were tribes that lived in what is now modern-day New Mexico that were making this, the oldest American beer is chicha.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go.
There you go.
And it's still a cornerstone of South and Central American cultures. You can even, like, I've heard this from other friends that have visited Peru, like, like families will put like a bamboo post outside of their house with maybe like a red flag, like flowers. And it kind of is their way of saying like, we make this and you can buy it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And it's still kind of a cornerstone for a lot of their economy, for a lot of like individuals.
It's like a thing that a lot of people rely on for their livelihood.
Yeah. And this was cool too. It was always traditionally made by women. Obviously, children and men, they have a hand in it too and can. But early on, it gave women the ability to have capital and power.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very, like, a very important tool for, like, generating and controlling wealth for women. Now, the one, of course, that lands it on these lists, as I mentioned, it's called Chicha de Muco. And what it is like, the maize is rolled in little balls. You chew it. And as you start to break it down, your saliva imparts taurin, which is an enzyme that converts the cornstarch into fermentable sugar. So the chewed up corn, which is called, that's the muco is the, that's what it's called. So the muco is then, it's dried out and then it's like combined with some more cornmeal, any spices, fruits, nuts you want to add into it. You know, cooked on the stove, and it's let to ferment for like a week, and that's your chicha.
Okay.
Now the ways that do not include the chewing are you can just add additional sugar.
Right.
You can just cook this on the stove and then just take it off, and that's when we're talking about the non-fermented ones. So it's all something that's made in the house. It's easy and safe to produce without a lot of equipment or any sort of real expense.
All right.
And it's not like it's the only culture to use saliva in early forms of fermentation. This was actually one of the ways that sake was made.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. You would actually chew the rice grain to start to impart the same like breakdown of sugars and like impart the same enzymes.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it's like I said, it's a massive category all throughout South and Central America. It is a the way they describe the flavor is like with all these spices and fruits and like the corn base, which I feel like would be super tasty. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of dying to try this.
Yeah, like, for sure.
In any form. And I, you know, it's a really cool storied traditional beverage. So I'd say that if you come across it, you should try it. Make some at home. Apparently it's something you can do.
Really? Okay. Yeah. I don't know if we're going to be trying that tonight, but.
That seems like it's a lot of labor. I've got
TMJ, so.
Okay. I'm not bothered about the chewing. Like, I don't know. I mean, you share drinks all the time. Like, you know.
Yeah. And then also, like, the process that it goes through after, like, with the, you cook it and you ferment it. Like, you know, like, I mean, fermentation involves a lot of, like, enzymes and living cultures that, you know, like, I mean, I don't know if you're, like, if it's, like, bacteria you're worried about, like, that is literally part of the brewing of a lot of spirits. So, you know.
And I just think it's cool that it's something from our bodies that can go into the fermentation process.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Yeah, so, okay. So I'm gonna talk about another cultural oddity, but not really, because this is something that's really popular and important among, like, the peoples of Central Asia. So that would be, like, the peoples of Hungobugger, Turkic and Mongol origin. And I'm talking about kumis. It's actually a fermented dairy product, which is originally made from mare's milk. So it's similar to kefir. Do you say kefir or kefir?
I've heard kefir.
Kefir. It's similar to that, but it's produced from a liquid starter culture. But mare's milk contains more sugars than cow's milk or goat's milk when it's fermented. So kumis has a higher, though still mild, alcohol content in comparison to kefir. Mm. And as far as like production, even in the areas of the world where kumis is popular, mare's milk is still kind of a limited commodity. So there are industrial scale productions that generally use cow's milk, but they need to, you know, use additives like sucrose or whey to mimic the mare's milk, because mare's milk is lower in fat and proteins than cow's milk, but it's higher in lactose, so it acts a little different chemically. Mm. And it's very light in body compared to most dairy drinks. It has a unique, slightly sour flavor with a bite from the mild alcohol content. And it's usually served cold or chilled, like you would drink most dairy things, but it's kind of consumed like beer in Central Asia. And this is just like, this is dating back, like it's mentioned among like the ancient Greek cultures. There's like some people who were traveling around that time who wrote about it, but, you don't usually think of like milk and alcohol together. Right. But at the same time, like yogurt is fermented milk culture.
Right.
So this is just kind of taking that a step further and making like an alcoholic drink. And we did experiment with that when we did the soju episode with yogurt and alcohol, and it was really tasty.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, it's funny because we have this understanding of we have drinkable yogurt that's fermented.
Right.
And so if you just let the fermentation go enough to develop a significant alcohol content, it's sort of the same scale, like it's,
right,
it's funny that it's thought of like, oh, how weird, fermented milk,
right?
It's like,
and I think
we drink that all the time.
And I think another part of it is that it's horse milk, so like people get kind of weirded out by that, but it's just like, that's kind of strange because it's so like it's not any more weird than it is for humans to drink milk from a cow or a goat, like you know, like you're still, it's actually kind of strange that we drink milk from a cow, you know, when you really think about it, it's kind of weird.
Well, I mean,
you're not meant to.
You're talking to a vegan here. I drink milk from nuts.
Right. Well, even, but like, I mean, I drink milk from nuts too. I'm lactose intolerant, but yeah, like even without the industry that's problematic around cow's milk, but like just like the fact that like we are not supposed to really be drinking milk after we've been weaned, and like we're drinking milk from a different species. But okay, that's fine. I guess like it made some of these lists because they're like, oh, it's alcoholic horse milk. So weird. Like it doesn't really seem that bad to me.
Well, and it's definitely like in the palate. I mean, it makes me think of like a lot of like unfiltered sakes, which I know that's not an animal product, but it's still, you are like, rice milk is a thing.
Right.
When you're not filtering sake, it has a lot of the same consistency, a lot of the same notes as like a rice milk. Like it's just all, it's all stuff that we've experienced across the spectrum. It's just put together in one, in like a beverage that maybe isn't necessarily familiar to us culturally in our very limited cultural landscape.
Yeah.
Similar to that is what I want to talk about next, which is something that I was lucky enough to try before I went vegan, and that is Pechuga Mezcal.
Okay, what's in it that's not vegan?
Well, all right, so it's real quick for anyone that doesn't know what Mezcal is, we'll do a Mezcal episode
or five.
It's my favorite spirit. But Mezcal is like fast and loose. It's basically tequila, but the agave plants are smoked. So like think smoky tequila. That's a real shorthand of mezcal. It's so much more than that, but that's how you can think of it if you're not familiar with it. But this one particularly, Pechuga Mezcal, it's made seasonally in like mainly in the Oaxaca region of Mexico, and usually in the fall or winter. And it's unique because it's got meat in it.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. Some savory spirits.
Well, so what happens is you make your mezcal your traditional way, which is usually twice distilled. But then for the third distillation, you actually hang traditionally a chicken breast in the still.
Okay.
And actually the word pechuga means breast in Spanish. So there you go. It's in the name.
All right.
Now, so it's like, as it's a raw chicken breast originally, but the steam and the heat inside a still, we're heating the liquid enough to evaporate it and distill it, so that gets real hot in there. It cooks the meat, it kills the bacteria. There's no risk of bacterial involvement.
All right.
And what does happen is the collagen and the fats, they are get added into the mezcal.
Okay.
And it creates, it adds a little bit of a savory flavor, but more so it adds a different like texture to the mezcal.
Okay. Yeah.
Like sort of a smooth, richer, kind of like silkier texture.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. And then what they'll usually do is in the still with the chicken breast, they'll put like harvested fruits, grains, spices, vegetables, like things that are ripe in that season.
Stuff that you would probably like stuff a turkey with.
Yeah. So you're basically making distilled turkey mezcal. Like, right. That's kind of, if we think of it in the, like our American way, like, yes, like, you've got all of your seasonal fruits and vegetables and nuts.
Right.
And
well,
your meat.
you do beer can chicken. Why wouldn't you do it the other way around?
That's kind of what it is. It's like if you could add a little teeny chicken inside the beer. but yeah, so the fruits and the nuts and everything kind of they balance out the savory notes that the meat adds. Like I said, it's usually chicken. It can be turkey. People have used lamb, deer, rabbit. There was even like a piece that I found where like world renowned chef Jose Andres partnered with Del Maguey, like a huge mezcal company, to make this special ham mezcal.
Ooh, okay.
it's becoming, and this method, which is super traditional, like I remember when it was first described to me, like, it's funny that as I am now a vegan, at the time a bartender asked me, I was just at a friend's bar, they had a really great back bar, they had a lot of mezcals, and I told them that I was just kind of, at the time, this is like years ago, I was learning what mezcal was. I was kind of getting into it. And my bartender was like, oh, well, are you vegetarian? I'm like, what does that have to do with if I can have this mezcal or not? He was like, oh, it matters.
It matters if you're a vegetarian.
Yeah, so he was like, yeah, they ferment meat into this. And I just had this whole idea of like, what they like put up, do they throw meat into the vat? Like, what do you mean? Like, I don't get it. No, it's not really that. It's more just like some, you know, it's like we understand like conceptually like bacon infused like vodka, like has like fat washed.
They captured the vapor and the essence of it and they put it in the spirit.
Yeah.
That's
kind of
cool.
Yeah. And in more modern times, people have used this kind of idea of putting something in the still while you're distilling something on its like final round as a way of flavoring it. Because there are like companies now in America that are picking up on this trend. And like, a company that like hung like a whole pineapple in its still.
Okay.
So the pineapple vapors would like. Yeah. And then like, you know, also using like ham, using like local fruits, using apples. So the idea of like adding something to the still that will also get like add to the vapors that are being like evaporated and distilled, it's like just becoming like a cool new technique for changing how to make something.
And you get to cook a dinner at the same time.
Yeah. All I wanted to know was what, if that's like,
do they eat it afterwards?
I couldn't find any information on that.
I bet the people who make it, that's how it works. If you made it, then you get to eat it.
Maybe. I don't even know, but I just want to know, like, how much alcohol, like, gets caught up in that hanging chicken breast.
Oh, is it, like, then, right, does it become, then it's, like, mezcal-infused chicken?
I don't know,
Do they, is it an equal infusion?
That's what I'm not sure.
I'm dying to know.
I really love the idea of, like, okay, we've made our beautiful pechuga mezcal, and now we are going to get drunk on this chicken breast.
Yes! Yes! But, I'm into it.
But if you are...
I feel like that works.
Yeah. And if you're not a vegan or a vegetarian, there are a lot of pechugas, like more and more each year, flooding the American marketplace. So you should definitely check it out. It's a cool product.
Well, while we're on the topic of putting animals in spirits,
this is when we kind of take a step away from spirits that I would say are things to seek out, but just have a little bit of like an eyebrow raise because they're made in ways that we might not fully understand or feel comfortable with, into the world of like, well, that's okay.
Well, this is still cultural.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about snake bile wine.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that's served as, it's served at specialty restaurants all over Vietnam, a lot of countries across Asia. This is a delicacy and it's traditionally prepared tableside by a handler, like a snake handler with a live snake. And what they will do is they will slice open a live cobra's gallbladder and then they blend its bile with rice wine. So traditionally, the greenish-black mixture is served with an invigorating aperitif to subsequent sources made from the remaining parts of the snake. And this is kind of like where we get into a little mysticism, because this is something that is not done for flavor. It's done for virility. So men are strongly advised to ingest this drink, and allegedly it promotes fertility and a host of other health benefits. And that's like kind of the a little bit of mysticism that's held with this belief of, like, you know, if you drink this, it's going to be good for fertility. Like, I think that goes along with a lot of, like, cultural symbols of virility. The snake is in there probably because of its phallicness.
Right.
But unlike the pechuga, which we know, like, it gets cooked as it's being infused with the alcohol, and there's no health risk with that, there actually is some health risks that have been proved and have come forward in, like, the last 20 years. So the Chinese Consumer Council actually came forward in 1998 and warned that although snake bile is reputed to calm the mind and eliminate phlegm, because, you know, we got to get rid of that phlegm.
All right.
You know, what are you going to do if you got too much phlegm? You got to eat some snake bile. So although it's reported to have these health benefits, or believed to have these health benefits, eating it raw can actually lead to serious disease. Because, like, the snake's gallbladder is removed as soon as the reptile is killed, and then it's stored in wine. A lot of people think that means that it's sterilized. However, the alcohol content of the wine is usually about, like, 30% to 50%. So it's less than the best concentration for disinfection, which is, like, about 70% at least. Because, like, you know, the tableside method is, like, that's usually traditional. And that's going to come with the same risks as if you just, like, get a snake gallbladder raw from the market. It's usually sold intact, so the alcohol doesn't kill the germs inside is okay. Part of the risk. Although maybe they're like, this counts when the Chinese Consumer Council did this report, you know, they're going to be respectful to traditions, and they're going to say, yeah, maybe eating snake parts of snakes can have some health benefits, but it's still a risk if you eat those things raw. There's been reports of people on the mainland and in Taiwan eating raw snake bile and then developing serious health problems, like becoming infected with snake parasites, like parasites that were living in the actual animal,
right?
Or even contracting acute hepatitis.
But, you know, and I feel like this is, we talk about, like, things that we've accepted as, like, normal. This is just normal. And then sometimes, right, like, oh, that's weird. It's like, we already have an understanding, like, if you eat, say, sushi, like, yes, mm-hmm, there are proper ways of preparing it, but there is always a possibility of having parasites in fish.
Right.
There are lots
anything
of things
you consume raw.
Yeah, if you have unpasteurized cheese, if you have raw fish, if you have raw eggs, there's always a certain risk, but these things are normalized. And then other things get this kind of weird pass of, like, but this is,
right,
this is weird and dangerous. It's like, but is it just that there's a cultural acceptance? Mm-hmm. And I don't know enough of, like, the, obviously, the medical statistics.
Right.
But it does seem like, well, if you eat raw fish, you do always have a,
exactly,
risk of parasites.
Especially,
like,
most fish have parasites.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, you know, like, if we look at it objectively, like, the real risk here is actually, like, just because you're consuming something raw. Like, right, whereas, like, you know, like, you could get duck liver in a restaurant and not think that that's weird.
Yeah.
Like, this is, the gallbladder is, like, just another organ in the animal. So if you don't think that having a liver pate or whatever is weird, then I don't think you should necessarily consider this any more odd. It's just that if you're gonna try this, maybe you gotta be a little bit careful, or just realize that you're taking on that risk.
Well, I think that's good anytime you're consuming, yeah, something that comes with risks, to know those risks, but to not treat something as not on the same level of things that we're more familiar with. Like,
right.
And I mean, stigma around, yeah, certain things just because we don't know them, or we don't know we like them yet. I think,
right,
that's more it. Like, once you try and pasteurize cheese, you're like, this is delicious. Like,
right,
whatever. It's like, okay.
Although I will say that I believe that from what I've heard about snake bile wine, you don't really consume it for the taste. It's more about, like, the
fair,
health benefits,
fair,
or like you think this is going to make increase your fertility. Mm. But you would traditionally consume something like snake bile wine as more of, like, a delicacy, or like you would do it in small quantities, and it wouldn't necessarily be for the taste of it.
Right.
But okay. It's not the only thing that it's not the only thing you could do with snakes.
Well, I guess if you don't want to mess around with all that like delicate like gallbladder removal. You could just put the whole snake in your wine.
I guess you could.
Snake wine, scorpion wine, sometimes snake and scorpion wine. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's whole snakes, whole scorpions infused into rice wine, but also you can find it in just like grain spirits.
Okay.
So higher proof spirits will have it sometimes too. This dates back to China during the Zhou Dynasty around 1000 BC. It was the same as like you were talking about. It was thought to encourage like strength and vigor. Virility was part of it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it's still found throughout China, Vietnam, and Southeast Asia. It is made just that simply of putting whole scorpions and snakes into rice wine or grain spirits alive and letting them drown.
Ooh.
Now, this is the cruelty aspect of that. I'm not going to say, well, it's culture and it's not ours, so I'm not going to disrespect it. That part is a little shocking to me as someone that doesn't.
I still eat meat. Occasionally, I don't eat a lot of it, but I do, and I don't like anything that's like you know how the animal died and it wasn't nice. Like,
yes, I agree.
Can't do that. No. Drowning is a terrible way to die.
It is, and this is like so. If you didn't like that, I'm sorry, because it can get a little worse. Sometimes for the snakes, they will actually shock them with ice first to sort of like. To make them pass out, lose consciousness, okay. And while they're down, they'll surgically remove their intestinal tract, other digestive organs, because that taste will sour the wine or make it taste a little off. It adds a bitterness, but it won't exactly kill them. So sometimes they'll come back to life. While drowning.
I don't like it.
And they take on this very defensive pose.
Ooh. That's like, okay, I did see some of these.
Yeah, when they're so coiled like, and they look,
they look like they're about to strike.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
fuck. Oh, my God.
It's rough. I don't, like, I'm not, like I said, it's culture. To me, like, this is as an animal rights activist, I'm like, I don't like anything about this. Ooh. But we're just here to give you the facts. Right. You know, we're not here to judge. We're here to give you the facts.
But if you try it someday, you know, write us. Let us know what you thought about it, how it tasted.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know.
So it is aged. They put the animals in and then it's aged. And now the one thing that's true is like the venom does. It's obviously they usually use venomous snakes and obviously scorpions have venom in them. But because we're talking about a protein-based venom, the ethanol very quickly interacts with the venom and the proteins unravel in the ethanol, so it's completely safe.
That's kind of cool.
It destroys the poisons.
All right, I'd be interested to know what snake venom tastes like when it's not going to kill you.
I mean, I guess that's part of the drink.
Yeah.
And these are, you know, like they look very intimidated in the bottle. I think that's the shock factor of the bottle. It goes back to the same stuff, like what it's supposed to impart to the person who imbibes it.
Right.
It's usually taken in shots because while it is sometimes found in lower alcohol suspensions, it's generally more commonly found in higher alcohol spirits.
Yeah. I mean, that would make sense if you wanted to preserve the specimen.
Yes.
Well,
it's gonna get worse from here, huh?
It is. You know what? I don't, this is one that I don't really feel that bad saying that I think this is kind of gross because this is, I'm gonna talk about three penis wine.
I don't want.
Do you not, or were you gonna say you don't want even one penis in your wine?
Not even one.
So three penis wine contains seal penis, deer penis, and Cantonese dog penis.
Oh, no.
You know, you need the three ones because, you know, you gotta spread it out. I don't know. So this is also like an ancient Chinese virility treatment. And in fact, like they believe so strongly that this is going to affect your fertility that there is a warning that young boys should not drink it because they're not ready. I mean, I guess like they probably shouldn't drink it anyway because it's alcohol. And adult men shouldn't drink too much. They'll have too much virility.
Okay.
And from what I read, it tastes something like an expired port. with a pungent vinegar taste and some, like, with some prune juice. And upsettingly, and reportedly, you can actually taste the distinct flavor profiles of the three different penises.
Oh, okay. How would you know?
Well, that's, I wondered that too. I did read an article that was like describing that, like, was like distinctly dog penis. But I, again, I don't know how you know that. How do you know? But yeah, that's what people who have drank it say, that you can taste the different penis tastes. And also they say it's not good in cocktails because the flavor will definitely overpower anything else you put in drink.
Good to know.
If you are going to drink it, it's best cold. If you can get it as cold, penis wine is the best if it's the coldest. And I would only assume that that means because of like when you chill something, it usually calms the flavor down a little bit. So yep. But seriously, like, no one should ever have more than one sip of this ever.
Okay, well,
and that's how they treat it. Like, it's very, like, it's supposed to be like very, very special. Like, you only have one sip and it's supposed to have these magical properties. So if you're really, really looking for a solution to that, you need some virility, then there you go. That's what you can do. You can have one sip.
How about some, I don't know, Viagra's all over the place.
But before Viagra, they had this.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and I want to be respectful of cultures that are not mine, but I also think that animal, like, not being cruel to animals matters. And this is a line that I'm just going to recognize. I'm going to go meta and recognize that I am trying to walk. Because I'm going to talk about something that I is in the same family.
Okay. I'm afraid.
It's in the name. We're going to talk about baby mouse wine.
I don't like it already. Yeah. I don't like it.
No, I do. Like, I feel like we should have insisted upon this more. All of these things, and like, we looked at probably 15 lists that we found out there about things that are like weird and unusual spirits, and all of these things are commonly included on the same list. And I hope, if nothing else, you take away that there are spirits that are, they're traditional and they have culture behind them, and then there are things that are, you know, these are localized, they have sort of spiritual beliefs behind them, and they don't all go in the same category of it's weird. So I almost feel disrespectful, like, of artisanal things, like,
right, like the horse milk is, like, I just don't think it belongs in the same category as penis wine.
I get that they're all I think these are all interesting, and it's cool to, like, learn about them and know they're out there, but I do hope, just please, as a takeaway, we are not putting them on the same level. This is a bit of a
no way, and especially this one makes me sad.
Baby mice wine. Now, this originated either in ancient China or Korea. They both have them, like, in their history. So it's up for debate as to where it originated. And the idea behind it was, for people that were too poor to afford more, like, accepted legitimate forms of medication. It kind of began as, like, a sort of folk medicine. And baby mice wine, it was considered a cure-all. The main disease it was said to treat, though, was asthma.
Okay.
Now, I don't know. I will say I grew up with asthma. I had asthma, exercise-induced asthma, for most of my young life. And I will say, given the option between having asthma or drinking baby mice wine, I think I just would have just kept the reason to skip gym class sometimes.
Yep. I'll take the asthma.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
But it is exactly what it sounds like. So baby mice, they can be no more than 3 days old. Their eyes can't be opened, and they can have no hair. They are drowned alive in rice wine.
No.
And then it's aged for 12 to 14 months. And it's even suggested that, you know, if you're really sick, that eating one of the pickled baby mice is good for treating illness.
No, it's not.
And I mean, I was curious, like, what have people that have tried this? Because it's still out there. Like, you can still find it in I mean, I'm not sure. I don't think it's widely available, but, you know, it seems to be something that's still like a niche product that's out there in the market.
Okay.
And people compare the taste to gasoline.
Okay, great.
I wonder, I mean, I guess the, I don't know what gasoline tastes like.
I mean.
I feel like there was maybe a time in my young, like, edgelord, but specifically culinary life, where I would have wanted to know what both gasoline and baby mice wine tasted like, and I would have tried it on that reason. Now, not so much. People can change, but yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right. Wow.
All right.
Well, I'll do you one more. What about whiskey that's made from pee? What about that?
What do I think about that? I think.
Do you think this is where you tag on Twitter art or not art, because this is as it turns out, this is art. So I'm talking about Gilpin Family Whiskey, and it's actually created by artist James Gilpin, and he created it as a diabetes public engagement work. So this is art. This is what art is. This is based on the knowledge that large amounts of sugar are excreted on a daily basis by type 2 diabetic patients, especially elderly patients. And Gilpin actually, in creating this project, he thought he could start a conversation with healthcare professionals by proposing the idea as an art project. But then he heard an urban legend that actually led him to produce the product for real. And the urban legend was about a pharmaceutical factory based in a community of elderly people, and they would send representatives door to door exchanging like cushions and soft toys for tubs of urine. And then they would take the urine and process it to remove all of the chemicals they had originally been selling their consumers on the shelves of pharmacies. So he took this urban legend and decided, well, maybe the diabetic's sugar-rich urine could be used to create a high-end whiskey. So he actually recruited his grandmother and made a distilling system, and it turns out that works. It works. And apparently, reportedly, the whiskey's not bad either.
Wow.
Which makes sense, because it's like, basically, through the distillation process, you just extract the sugar, and then you use the sugar like you would in a normal whiskey distillation. I mean, like, you know, when I first brought this up, you said something like, that sounds like exploitation, like, but now that I know that it's an art project, okay, I'm like, yeah. Well, okay, well, not just like, because if it was just an art project, that's like a little bit pretentious, maybe. I don't know. But I do like the idea of like making a statement to talk to like healthcare professionals in that way. He said that, you know, the fact that I'm associating alcohol with a severe medical condition has upset some medical professionals that I've met during the process of my project. And he said that that was actually a very deliberate provocation on his part, and that he wanted to have a dialogue with healthcare professionals about the very real complications of living with diabetes. Because people still want to drink and eat unhealthy food. Like, people want to experience the messiness of everyday life. So that's like a part that's generally overlooked. And that's why he made alcohol with his grandmother's pee.
I mean, okay. Now, see, I do feel like, because this is, it's one thing when it's a cultural thing, when it's a traditional thing, I feel like we don't really have a right to make judgment on
it. I mean, you can judge it a little bit if you want.
But when it's like somebody that's like, you know, has the, this is just a chosen way that they are making art.
Okay.
I
mean, it's not like, I was like worried about the exploitation factor, but he's not selling it. It was only ever tasted as part of the art installation. Like, he's not like making a profit out of this. He's just saying like, I did this as a way to like make some waves and have conversations with healthcare professionals.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm on the fence about this one, to be honest. I don't know.
I would agree. I think I'm also on the fence about this. I feel like that is, I don't know what that's saying about people that he's actually harvesting from. I don't see how it improves their lives. I feel like it's a lot of shock factor.
Yeah.
But that's what we're actually, that leads right into what I'm going to tell you about.
Okay, great.
So while we're in the realm of shock factor, I'm going to tell you about the end of history.
You're going to tell me about the end of history?
I know how it ends.
Tell me. I have to know now.
I at least know how it tastes or read the reviews, and it's apparently not great. I'm talking about the end of history beer. Now, okay. End of History is a beer that was produced in 2010 by the Scottish brewery BrewDog. And it was their sort of final attempt to make the highest alcohol by volume beer in history. They'd gone back and forth with a couple of the brewing companies and continued to make higher alcohol beers. And the reason they call it End of History is it's kind of their last statement on this. This is the last thing they're going to do. This is sort of the last one they're interested about pursuing.
Okay.
Now, the beer itself clocked in at 55% alcohol by volume. So that's compared to, like, your average, like, beer 5 to 6%. This is 55%. That's higher than most, like, whiskeys, yeah. Vodkas.
You know. I don't know. I can't imagine that, like, a beer of that high alcohol would actually really taste that great.
Well, I mean, other people would agree with you. I looked into a lot of reviews. It's on Rate Beer. It's been reviewed across the internet. And it's a box-style beer that's been described as anywhere from, like, strong and unique to just terrible. Terrible. Just, okay. Just alcohol burn, and that's it.
All right.
But the thing that... The reason that it comes up on these lists of sort of weird spirits is its packaging. Each beer, and there's, like, an incredibly small amount of these. Like, the original run, it was, like, done in 10-bottle increments, and it's always been, like, a very limited product. But each one is presented inside the taxidermied carcass of usually a squirrel.
Ew, yep. No.
Yes. And now, of course, they claim that they're roadkill animals, so they're already dead. I don't understand preserved carcasses.
How you would get roadkill animals that you could reuse.
I don't know either, but this is what they claim. Now, and okay. When asked why, and this is the thing.
Why? That's what I want to know. Why?
When asked why, they say that it's because they wanted to push the idea of what beer could be.
Could be reminding you of roadkill?
Could be inside of a dead animal? Yeah, I guess it could be. I didn't need that idea. That wasn't like, how dare you? What a courageous idea you presented to the audience at large.
I never thought that beer could be like this. No, I didn't. No. Why would I think that?
I would never want it. And it's great. So, like, the original beer, it was, it's, of course, like I said, it's like Scottish brewery. It sold for like £700 in the UK, the initial run, which is like what? That's like almost $1,000.
I don't know what currency is.
It's something like that.
The exchange rate.
and then they brought it back in like 2016, 2017. Because basically Ohio had a law about how high you could brew your beer, how high alcohol you could brew your beer. I believe it couldn't be above 12%. Up until 2-3 years ago. So they passed this law basically, like, or they ended this law saying like alcohol or the alcohol content in beer can be as high as you wish. BrewDog was financing a brewery in Columbus, Ohio.
No, Ohio, stay out of it.
So in celebration, they made these beers available again as kind of, this is the first beer we're going to brew here.
Stop.
But they wanted donations for their new brewery. And so it's marked as like a $20,000 beer.
Who does it?
People. Why? That donated more than $20,000 could get this beer made for them in the second run.
Okay.
So that was the idea. Still in dead animals. And then that's fine if you want to support a brewery. BrewDog does some really cool beers. Like, I've had some of their beers. Their Punk IPA is great. Yeah, their Tactical Penguin is really cool. They have more affordable beers.
I mean, $20,000.
For a beer that comes in roadkill that has mixed reviews on if it tastes any good.
I think I'll pass.
I have to because I don't have $20,000. It's great to support support the breweries that you want to support. And that's, I guess it was just a bonus for donating that much. But I don't know. I don't know if I would want... That's a haunted beer.
That seems haunted. I mean, if you want to be haunted by squirrels.
Well, I guess there are other things you could be haunted with by your booze, which I think...
Oh, yeah. That's right. My favorite one. I'm going to tell you about it.
I saved this one for last.
So I'm going to tell you about our number 10 on this list, the sour toe cocktail. It's not really a cocktail.
No.
This happened, the first time it happened, it was in 1973, and it became a Dawson City tradition, and it is actually surprisingly exactly what it sounds like. It's an actual human toe that has been dehydrated and preserved in salt.
Whose toe?
And it's used as a garnish of your choice. Well, the first toe is said to have been, it belonged to a miner and rum runner named Louis Lakin. And he had to have his toe amputated in the 1920s because he had frostbite. So what he did was he preserved it in a jar of alcohol in his cabin for memories.
That used to be my toe. Okay, all right. Well, you know, hey, frostbite happens.
Yeah, roughly 50 years later, in 1973, a Yukon local, Captain Dick Stevenson, found the jar containing the toe while he was cleaning the cabin, and Captain Dick brought the toe down to the Sourdough Saloon, and then he thought, well, why don't I just start plunking it down in some drinks and see who's brave enough and has got the gumption to drink alcohol from a cup that has a mummified toe in it. Let's see.
Okay.
And that's how the Sour Toe Cocktail Club was formed. So, unfortunately, for Louis Lakin's toe, it only lasted 7 more years because in July 1980, a miner named Gary Younger was trying for the Sour Toe record, and on his 13th glass of Sour Toe champagne, which means that he drank a glass of champagne with a mummified toe in it 13 times.
Well, okay, that's just a bad idea.
And a 13 is fitting. It's the unlucky number that his chair tipped over backwards, and he swallowed the toe.
He ate a toe.
Safe to say they didn't get that toe back.
No. Oh, no.
Yep. And since then, 7 more toes have been donated to the bar. Donated, yes. Okay. Donated. So number 2 toe was given after an amputation due to an inoperable corn, which is gross because that toe's got a corn on it.
Well, maybe that added some different...
Stop. Okay. No, I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
Don't you dare say flavor profiles.
I am
profiles.
Trying to be open-minded and understanding
all
of these.
See, when we were going through the list of oddities that we have compiled here, after I heard this story, I compared everything to, but is it as gross as a mummified toe in your drink? A human toe.
Yeah, well, no. I mean, that's definitely...
All right. Okay, so then there was another after toe number 2. I don't know what happened to toe number 2, but then there was a toe number 3. There was another victim of frostbite, but that toe was also accidentally swallowed.
That seems like it's real hard not to swallow a toe.
Oh, my God. This is really hard, guys. I'm sorry. Toe 4 was an anonymous toe, and it was stolen. Somebody stole the toe.
I guess that sounds like a thing that a teenager would do.
I don't know. I just don't know. And then there was the 5th and 6th toes that were donated by a Yukon old-timer in return for free drinks for his nurses.
Well, that's really nice.
It seems like most of the donated toes came from people who were like, well, I'm going to lose my toe anyway, so you can have it.
Yeah, I would do that in my lifetime. If I had to lose a toe, I would
You would give
happy.
It to this bar?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, great, because it seems like they're in need of toes. Toe 7 came from an amputation to diabetes. Toe 8 arrived in a jar of alcohol with the message, don't wear open-toe sandals while mowing the lawn.
Oh, no.
And then in 2013, a man came in the bar, ordered a sour toe shot, swallowed the toe on purpose.
Okay.
And paid the $500 fine. That's how much it was at the time. And like promptly exited the saloon. And that's actually the first and only time the toe was deliberately consumed.
So this dude was just like, I got $500. What could I do with this?
I'll eat a toe because that's what I want to do with $500. Like, there are strip clubs. Did you know that there are strip clubs?
Well, but wait a second.
Did you know that there's gambling? And there's also, like, I don't know, there's fancy clothes, there's Xboxes, there's a lot of things that you can buy for $500. You could go on you could buy yourself a plane ticket somewhere nice.
I'm just more concerned that was, like, for a moment, that's weird, like, legalized cannibalism. Ooh. Like, for $500, you can have somebody's toe. If that was on the internet, you'd get arrested for that. But that's basically it. If there's a fine, then right. That's well, the...
Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing. It was a fine because they did not want you to swallow the toe. If you broke the rules and swallowed the toe, then you had to pay. And they since...
That's a loophole.
They since... And that's why they since have increased it to $2,500.
Okay, so now it's a $2,500 edible toe.
Okay, I see your point. this toe is actually pretty coveted. In 2017, not too long ago, the toe was stolen again and later returned via mail to the owner. I don't know if they meant the owner of the bar or the owner of the toe.
Oh, I hope it, like, somebody just sent your toe back. That no, it's got to be the owner of the bar.
I hope so. I don't know. I feel like that would be upsetting to get a toe in the mail no matter what the circumstance was. Yeah, so they had rules for it. Obviously, don't eat the toe is the rule. You have to pay a fine if you break it. The rules have changed a little bit. Now you can pair it with any drink. There's just one rule. You can drink it fast. You can drink it slow. But the lips have got to touch the toe.
I hate it.
I hate that rule. That's terrible. But if you do want to check it out and go to the Sourdough Inn, toe time occurs nightly between 9 and 11 p.m. That is when you can take a shot of toe.
All right.
Yeah. So in comparison to some of the things that we've talked about, what do you actually think about my recording drink that I had earlier? I had gin and pickle juice.
I think that's fine.
Yeah. Taylor said it tasted like meat.
It did taste like, I mean, it's been a while since I've had meat, but that reminds me about like a Hickory Farm sausage.
I just like pickle juice. I don't think it tastes like sausage.
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've had sausage. Maybe I forget what that tastes like.
I think you do, but it's okay. It tastes savory. I understand that. It was salty.
Yeah. I mean, and like I said, like, I think a lot of the things on the list, it kind of, like, from, like, somebody that appreciates the history behind spirits, the inclusion of some of these in these kind of clickbait articles that just give you, like, a two-sentence description, like, this is made from human saliva. Ooh! It's like, no, it's a long and storied history, and it's, like, got a whole cultural significance. Like, it doesn't belong on the same list as toe shot.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
And I realize we have gone into detail enough of them that you can parse out what is cool, what is kind of weird, what is maybe something that's just for the shock value. There's a story behind every one of these spirits, some of which are a little silly, some of which are really cool.
I mean, I would just, like, my advice to anyone at this point would be, if you think that something, like, especially if you're in another country and you're trying out something that's part of the custom but seems a little weird to you, just ask yourself, how bad is it in comparison to drinking champagne or any spirit with a disembodied toe?
Which is right here here in America.
That's in America.
Yeah, we got the toe drink.
We got the toe drink. You know, I'm really interested in someday traveling with this podcast, but that's something I don't want to do. I don't want to drink that toe. What do you think? Yeah,
I don't know. You only go around once.
You would do it? Would you take a toe shot?
I wouldn't eat the toe.
No, don't eat the toe, definitely. But
I don't have $25 toe dollars.
No, don't eat the toe. Do not eat the toe. That's not part of the shot. That's not officially part of the shot. But it has to touch your lips. It's got the toenail on it still.
I'm gonna think about that when I'm in that bar and I've had some drinks, and then I'll decide that for myself. That's future Taylor's problem.
You have to have many non-toe drinks before you consider a toe drink. I'm so glad that we've had the chance to bring you this quality content.
Try, just because something seems different to you doesn't mean it's bad or weird or gross. Open yourself up to cultural experiences. But, you know, you can also, like...
You also don't have to drink the toe.
You don't have to drink the toe.
But thank you for listening. And thank you for everyone who donated to our Patreon and to all our new Patreon members. It's really, really helping us out. We use that money to pay for the supplies we need to make some good cocktails for you, not toe cocktails. We're also in the process of updating our equipment. So if you want to be one of our Patreon supporters, we will put that link in our show notes. And if you do decide to support us, we are asking our supporters on Patreon to send us a booze-related question that we will answer on the podcast sometime. Can't tell you when, but it will be sometime. Thanks to everyone who tweeted and retweeted about the show this week. It helps us get the word out there. And some of the people that we're so happy and lucky to have you tweeting about us is City Screams Your Name, Purple Worm, Mary Smurl, M at Kumo Dreaming, Spirit System, Maro Tubunpun, Scholar of No Importance, Vamprick Cringe Compilation, Moxie, Michael Beck, Ladies of Strange Podcast, Zeewee, Reginald, Austin Wills,
our MVP,
Joe Whitaker,
our other MVP.
Oh, Miak Smash. That's cute.
Miak Smash.
Miak Smash. Sydney McElroy. Thanks, Sid.
Thank you, Sid.
The Diabolical DV. And anyone else we missed, thank you so much. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NeatTheBoozeCast. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. And if you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe and give us a review if you like. And then we're about to head over to Taylor's kitchen and make some cocktails. None of them are going to be as gross as sour toe cocktails. That's just where we stand tonight.
I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat. And I've been super grossed out.
Oh, not
about toes. Not about everything. Just about toes. The toe thing is the worst thing.
The toe.